and you look at that one screen, that one user interface, and in that one screen is the entire history of civilization, right?
Right.
If you look at like a video, well, you couldn't have this video if they hadn't invented the computer, and they hadn't invented the telephone, right, and they hadn't invented the camera, right? And then, but you look at more basic stuff, like it'll say Wednesday. Well, what is this concept of Wednesday, right? Where did that come from? And it'll say, you know, April 12th. Well, where did this concept of 12 come from? Right? That goes back to the Hindus. Or even like, where did all these little squiggly shapes come from? This W, where did W come from, right? And you go back to the Phoenicians and the invention of the
alphabet. Right, right.
And even more basic than that, where did language come from? Now you're all the way back to Africa and these early humans and they who spoke the first words and formed the first gestures. So the thing is, you couldn't have an iPhone if people hadn't invented language, right?
Certainly.
So it really is all connected, and it really is. When you look at a user interface, you're looking at the history of everything, right? Mm-hmm.
That was Kevin Knob, and you are listening to the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I am your host. This is my show. It's an excuse that I've pretty much created to sit down with fascinating people, and I use the lenses of risk, resilience, uncertainty, randomness to explore all kinds of topics. And the results, I think, are pretty interesting, pretty entertaining, and very insightful. The show is free of charge. It always will be. But the one thing I ask is that if you enjoy it, please subscribe, share it, leave a rating or a review, particularly on iTunes. That helps us out a lot. That would be very much appreciated. Today's episode is episode 12. It's the 12th full episode, full long-form interview that I've done. And there's a reason why I chose the number 12 for today's guest. And to find out, you'll just have to listen to the episode. But before I introduce my guest, I'd like to give a shout out and some encouragement to one of my listeners, Andre Goritz, who is based in the US in California, just outside of Los Angeles. He is currently attempting to set a world record for the most distance cycled in 30 days. That's 11,400 kilometers or 7,076 miles. In order to do that, he's got to cycle 380 kilometers per day on average. That's 236 miles. A fantastic endeavor, certainly a huge challenge. I wish him all the best. I'll put the tracker in the show notes so you can see how he's doing, and maybe I'll even have him on the show to talk about it. So a great example of someone taking some risks. Okay, on to the show today, and I'd like to start with a very simple, straightforward question, and that is, how did everything come to be the way that it is? Just a simple question. Well, with that, I'd like to introduce my guest, Kevin Knob. Kevin is a user experience designer. He's based in the US in Philadelphia. User experience designer. We'll get into what that is, but he has an interesting background. He's worked at Apple, and he actually designed the online help manual for the Mac operating system. So we'll get into that. But for the purposes of this show, he runs a blog, and he is working on a book of the same name, and the title is The Making of Sense, and that attempts to answer that question, how did everything come to be the way it is? The blog is awesome, and basically what Kevin does, he applies sort of his design background to all kinds of things, and he asks the simple question, why did they design it like that? And if you read his posts, you come to the understanding that all kinds of things that are very common, that we take for granted, they've been designed on the basis of some quirks of history perhaps, on randomness at times, and perhaps also on the needs of that particular era, whenever that thing was designed, that perhaps aren't all that relevant now. And it makes for some fascinating blog posts and a fascinating discussion. I also find that whole concept to be strangely empowering because it implies that a lot of things that we take for granted in many respects are quirks of history, of fate, perhaps haven't been all that intelligently designed as we may have thought. And we talk about those kinds of things. We talk about things like numbers, writing, and the alphabet. We have an interesting conversation about time, both the calendar time. He has a wonderful proposal for a better calendar I'm fully supportive of. I'm not sure if it'll ever get any traction, but I think is much better than our current system. The concept of time itself, and this is a very trippy conversation. We get into the theory of relativity, Albert Einstein and his consoling of the family member of a longtime friend. We talk about music. We talk about art. We talk about randomness in design itself. It's a very insightful and I think a very entertaining conversation. I think you're going to enjoy it a lot. So let's go right into it. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Kevin Knob. Enjoy.
Kevin, thanks for joining me. I came across you just by a stroke of chance, as we often do. Uncertainty and randomness. So I came across your blog, The Making of Sense, and I thought, what a cool blog, and thought I'd find out a little bit more about what you do, and sure. Decided to invite you to come on the show, and sort of a cold approach. I mean, I really appreciate you coming on, and thanks for taking a bit of time to talk to me today. I thought it would be great to start with your background. You're a user experience designer, or what is it? How do you what is that, and how did you get involved in that?
So my job is to design software in a way that is easy to use, mm-hmm. and easy to learn, efficient to use, and I'm actually an English major. Mm-hmm. I have a master's in professional writing from Carnegie Mellon over mm-hmm. in Pittsburgh. And I started my professional career as a technical writer. So I worked at Apple from 1988 to 1998. Mm-hmm. I basically worked at Apple when Steve Jobs did not.
Right.
And I have to admit, Apple did better when Steve was there than when I was. I'd like to think that's more of a reflection on him than it is on me.
I'm sure it is.
I started there as a technical writer, so I wrote user manuals for Apple products. Mm-hmm. Plug this into that, click here, click there. And what Apple was trying to do at the time was reduce the cost of their inbox material. So they wanted to get all these big 300-page books out of the box. Mm. And so we designed an online help system. And that was my big design project at Apple. I designed the online help system for the Mac OS. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of made the transition from print to electronic media. And I did a lot of usability testing at Apple. And I live in near Philadelphia now. I've worked in e-commerce. I've worked in publishing. Right now, I work for a financial services company, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I'm a soldier in the digital revolution.
Right. And what makes a good user experience then in your illustrious career in the discipline?
Well, they say in real estate, they say it's location, location, location. Mm-hmm. In human-computer interaction, it's the user's representation of the task, the user's representation of the task, the user's representation of the task. Right. So it's very a good UI is task-focused.
Okay.
Right? What's the user trying to do? What's the user's goal?
And right.
Your job as a user interface designer is to represent users' tasks. Right. So if the user's representation of the task is, I want to print this, and the system's representation of the task is a button labeled print, that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the user's representation of the task and the system's representation of the task are in harmony like that,
mm-hmm.
it's a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't always work that way. Sometimes the system represents it in technical terms or in marketing terms, and it's not really speaking the user's language. Right?
Sure. Yeah, I think go ahead.
One of the things that I know, if you've ever seen these things, you see them on like college campuses and public areas. They'll put a sidewalk somewhere, and then you see there's like a path worn through the grass,
mm-hmm.
which is where people really wanted to walk.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Those are called desire lines.
Okay.
And some landscape architects will wait until the desire lines form before they pave a sidewalk. Right. And so you can think of user experience design as putting the sidewalks where the people want to walk.
Right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there's a lot of user research, you know, going out, talking to people, observing people, finding out, you know, how they do their jobs, and then designing systems around that. It's an iterative process. You do prototypes, you do usability testing of the prototypes, make revisions based on that, and you keep going until you run out of time, and then you ship the product.
Right. Okay. Okay. Now that's useful. I think there's nothing more frustrating than getting a product that you think you like and you just don't know how to make it work. And then for me, maybe this is a bit of an aside, but for me, one of the things that frustrates me, perhaps top five in life, but certainly top five in software or in technology is switchboard numerical. Switchboard. I don't know what you call those things when you call your local. Here we've got local councils, and you have to press 4 to go here, press 3 to go there. So that kind of thing just frustrates me to no end. Just
right. You know,
tell me where you know.
So talk about it in terms of risk. User-centered design is a way of mitigating risk in the software, in the product development process.
Mm-hmm.
It's reduces the chances that you're going to build the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
It reduces the chances that you're going to build something that people will not use, or if they have to use it, will result in errors and inefficiency and negative brand perceptions. And a lot of organizations are like, why do we need to invest in user experience design as a discipline? I mean, we're smart. We know how to build things. We have good taste.
Yeah.
Why can't we just build stuff, right? It's like that voice said to Kevin Costner in the movie, if you build it, they will come, right? But the reality is they might not come.
Yeah.
Right? If you build the wrong thing, they won't use it.
And yeah.
So by doing the user research and involving users in the design process, you greatly reduce the risk that you're going to screw up.
Right. I think for a lot of people, certainly for me, it's got to be intuitive. I'm the kind of person that won't read a 100-page manual. I'll pull the product out of the box and start fiddling around with it and trying to figure it out on my own, which for certain products isn't a great idea. But that's that's how I work, and I think how a lot of people work actually nowadays.
Yeah, back in the days when I was a manual writer, we would go out to, client sites, and I'd be all ready to ask them, what do you think of the manual? And I'd look up on the shelf, and the manual still was in the shrink wrap.
Mm-hmm.
They had my cover.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've definitely learned that people don't read the manual.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, that's good background. I wanted to talk a little bit about your book and your blog, The Making of Sense, and where the idea came from to put this blog together and this book together around some just you've got some wonderful posts there, and where did that come from? How did you how did you get there?
I look at the world through the eyes of a designer. And it's kind of a curse. Like, I'll go out to dinner with my wife, and I'm looking at the menu, and I'm thinking, you know, why did they use that font? Mm. why did they format the headings that way? I'm always looking at things and thinking, you know, why did they make it like that?
Mm-hmm.
But what actually prompted me to write the book and start doing this research was I have been trying throughout my whole life to learn how to play the piano, and I suck. I keep trying and I still suck. I'm like a perpetual beginner when it comes to the piano. I can't get over the hump. So I guess I was looking for an excuse, and I think I found one. I started thinking about the design of music notation, and it's a terrible design. And so imagine that you are the manager of a design consulting firm, and a client comes in and says, "Hey, could you design a system for music notation?" Right. So you assign the project to one of your designers, and he or she goes off and comes back a few days later with designs in hand and says, "Hey, I've got it. We're going to map the 7-note scale onto a staff of 5 lines." And you're like, okay. Oh, and you know how some notes are twice as long as others, and some notes are 4 times as long as others, and some notes are 8 times as long as others? Well, we're going to make the notes all the same size, right?
Yeah.
But some of them will be black, and some of them will be white, and some of them will have little tails on them, and some of them won't, and you'll be able to figure it out based on that. Well, you would probably fire that designer.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, send the designer back to the drawing board. I mean, it's one of these designs that, you know, it evolved back in the Middle Ages, and we're stuck with it. It's like entrenched in our culture. And if you were to assign that design project to a modern designer, I mean, any designer that's worth his latte could come up with a design that's much easier to learn, much easier to use. We know so much more about cognitive sciences now. We know so much more about effective design processes now. We could come up with something a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started thinking, like, you know, that was this question. Why did they design it like that? And so then I started applying that to looking around at everything, right? Why did they design writing the way they did? Why did they design maps the way they do? Why did they design computers and televisions and motion pictures the way they do? So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, and I guess what it seemed like you found is that, you know, it's a it's sort of a product of history and different arbitrary decisions, and you know, and those stories are really neat. But
I don't mean to berate the past.
I mean
we do stand on the shoulders of giants. I mean that we are the heirs of some brilliant design thinking. And I'm writing about that too. So and you know, the subtitle of the book is "How Did Everything from Language to the Internet Come to Be the Way It Is?" Well, that's kind of a audacious thing.
You need to be audacious to grab the attention. You know, it's a battle for eyeballs out there. So you know, go with it.
How do you write a book about everything? I mean, everything's kind of a broad topic, right? But I think it really is about everything. If you look at any user interface, so I got a text from my daughter, right? Mm-hmm. And she had embedded a little video of our dog in this text. Hmm. And you look at that one screen, that one user interface, and in that one screen is the entire history of civilization, right?
Right.
If you look at like a video, well, you couldn't have this video if they hadn't invented the computer and they hadn't invented the telephone, right, and they hadn't invented the camera, right? And then, but you look at more basic stuff, like it'll say Wednesday. Well, what is this concept of Wednesday, right? Mm. Where did that come from? And it'll say, you know, April 12th. Well, where did this concept of 12 come from, right? That goes back to the Hindus. Mm-hmm. Or even like, where did all these little squiggly shapes come from? This W, where did W come from, right? And you go back to the Phoenicians and the invention of the alphabet.
Right.
And even more basic than that, where did language come from? Now you're all the way back to Africa and these early humans and who spoke the first words and formed the first gestures. So the thing is, you couldn't have an iPhone if people hadn't invented language, right?
Certainly.
So it really is all connected, and it really is. It, when you look at a user interface, you're looking at the history of everything, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So those are the stories I like that I find interesting, and those are the stories I like to tell.
Okay. Well, let's talk about maybe one of those. Maybe, you know, you mentioned writing, and you talked about the Phoenicians, where does writing come from? Where does how we write come from?
Well, writing was not invented by the poets. Writing was invented by the bean counters.
Okay.
And it was invented in the first civilizations in Sumeria, right? So back then, they started collecting taxes, and you had to keep track of who owed what to whom, right? Hmm. So they would make these little shapes, like you'd have like, I paid Ben 3 goats, right? Mm-hmm. So I'd have like 3 little shapes that represented goats, and I would keep them sealed in a jar. And then somebody had the great idea, well, instead of having to have all these things, why don't I just press the shape of a goat into a piece of clay, right? Mm. And so then, you know, you start to say, well, this is fine if I want to just write about things like goats, but what if I want to write about something else? And they had this brilliant idea. It's called the rebus principle, where I would use a picture of something that sounds like the word that I am trying to use. And so then the Egyptians, they stole the idea. They had all of these. They had like 700 different glyphs. And they never realized that you didn't need that many. You only needed one for each sound in the spoken language, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was what the Phoenicians, this happened around, 1000 BC. The Phoenicians, there was no country called Phoenicia. Phoenicia was just a word that the Greeks came up to refer to these little city-states along the Mediterranean where modern-day Israel and Lebanon and mm-hmm. Syria are. So that's who the Phoenicians were. Mm-hmm. And one of these people came up with what is probably the single best design idea that anyone has ever had, which is to use a little picture to represent each sound in the spoken language. So it would be like an English speaker, using a little picture of a ball for buh. Or a little picture of a dog for duh, or a mm-hmm. little picture of a snake for suh, right? Mm-hmm. So, like what they did, they used, like for the huh sound, they used a picture of a fence, which was a word they pronounced heth, right? Mm. And so that's why a capital H kind of looks like a fence.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Huh. And for the K, they used a little picture of a hand, right? Mm. So that's why a K kind of looks like a hand with the fingers spread.
Okay.
And okay. So yeah, so that was a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
And you know, they traveled around, people would look at, they'd introduce this alphabet, you know, to the Greeks and the Hebrews and all these other cultures, and these other cultures would say, wow, that's a good idea. Right. It spread very quickly. So, so that's the alphabet.
Right. That's interesting. Did you look at, also the Chinese alphabet at all, or the Chinese, I guess it's not an alphabet. Yeah. It's pictograms.
Yeah.
Isn't
so
it?
That was invented. That was invented, completely independently.
Yep.
Of the Sumerians. And, so they have a very different system. It's more, you know, these logograms.
Yep.
As opposed to alphabet, which, is a lot harder to print.
Mm.
You know, when the Chinese, they tried to come up, they tried to invent movable type, you know, before Gutenberg did, but they had too many letters, right?
Mm.
If you have an alphabet with hundreds of letters, it's kind of hard to build a printing press. But if you have an alphabet with 26 letters, it's a much more manageable design task, right?
Yeah, that's interesting. I spent some time in Korea, and the Koreans invented, I can't remember exactly when, 15th century or something like that, but their own phonetic alphabet. They used the Chinese characters, but the phonetic alphabet was for the lower classes, and they came up with, I guess it was 26, 27 different sounds, because it... you know, huge amounts of illiteracy, and it was a way of getting people to be able to read and write, which is it's interesting how that's developed.
It's very powerful.
Yeah,
and you think about, so you know, I was talking about the printing press.
Yeah,
I mean, if you think life is tough now, you should have seen what it was like back before the invention of the printing press. Mm. I mean, you're much less likely to die of starvation.
Yes.
Or be killed by your government today than you were back then. And I think that all of the great achievements of modernity, right, the spread of democracy, the rise of science, the human rights movements, those would not have been possible if it hadn't been for, you know, mass literacy.
Hmm.
So, I mean, I'm an optimist. I believe that there is such a thing as progress, you know, that we really are, we really are moving toward better things with technology.
Yeah, I agree, and it also raises different types of challenges. But certainly, you know, it's hard to argue that we're not way better off than we were, you know, even 100 years ago, let alone 1,000 years ago. Even things like life expectancy, you know, we've kind of. I've read somewhere that, you know, we've outgrown our, you know, we would die at whatever, 50 years old or something, just shortly after, you know, our reproductive age. And now we live well beyond that, which, you know, creates different challenges, but it, you know,
And there are politicians here in the United States who keep talking about, let's go back to the good old days.
Yeah.
What days were that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm not sure when that was, but
yeah, we love to romanticize about the past. That's for sure. Speaking of which, wondering if we could maybe talk a little bit about time. You have a wonderful post about time and relativity, and I'm wondering if we could talk about that a little bit, because we seem like we don't have enough time nowadays, which is one of the challenges.
So imagine if you lived in a society that didn't have a calendar.
Yeah. Right?
How would you go about creating one? Well, you would probably pay attention to the cycles of the moon, right? Because lunar cycles are shorter than the solar year, and they're easier to track because you can see where you are within the cycle just by looking at the shape of the moon, right?
Yeah.
So all of these ancient calendars are lunar, right?
Yeah.
The Islamic calendar is lunar. That's why the symbol for Islam is a crescent moon.
Right.
The problem with a strictly lunar calendar is that it drifts out of sync with the solar year. It's off by like 12 days, right? So if you had a calendar that was just 12 lunar months and you were born in the middle of summer, your 16th birthday would be in the dead of winter, right? So cultures came up with different approaches to address this problem. Some of them came up with what they called an intercalary month, which was like a 13th month, which sometimes the year would have 12 months, sometimes the year would have 13 months. And the Hebrew calendar works that way. That's why, like, Yom Kippur, it jumps around on the calendar, but it's always kind of close to the, you know, autumnal equinox. Right? So we got our calendar from the Romans, from the ancient Romans. And the ancient Romans, they believed that even numbers were unlucky. So that all of the months were 31 days, either 31 days or 29 days, right? And so if you have a 31-day month, you've pretty much blown. You're going to be out of sync with the lunar calendar, right?
Right.
So people today don't really care very much about the moon, right?
No.
Like, you know when the next full moon is? I don't.
No.
People don't pay attention to the moon anymore. I mean, we expect our Christmases to be white, and we expect our Julys to be hot, but we don't care about the moon, right? And we got that who cares attitude about the moon from the Romans, right? And so what happened with the Romans was they didn't have a system for deciding when that 13th month was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
They assigned the decision to the head priest of Rome. And so what he did was he made it a political thing. So when his buddies were in office, he added the 13th month and made the year longer. And in years when his buddies were out of office, he said, no, we're just going to have 12 months this year, right? So seasonal drift became severe. And so along comes Julius Caesar, who is basically the dictator of the whole world. And he has the power to change that. And so he met with the leading astronomer of his time, and they knew that the year was, you know, 350, how many days are there? 365.25 days.
Yep.
And so they invented the Julian calendar, which is basically what we have today.
Right.
But I think what you were asking me before was sort of this deeper question of like, what is? Right?
Yeah, I did want to talk about that. Yeah.
So that's a question that people have been trying to get their heads around for a long time. Aristotle, he's sort of the philosopher of common sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
He said, time is the measure of change. He's, you know, time doesn't really exist independent of change.
Mm-hmm.
Isaac Newton, he had a similarly common sense notion, but he believed that time was actually woven into the fabric of the universe. That you had these three spatial dimensions, and then you had this fourth dimension of time, and it was all created by God. And it just sort of, and time extended infinitely into the past and infinitely, well, I guess it extended back to the moment of creation. And then just extends infinitely into the future, and it just sort of marches on in this absolute rhythm, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that worked fine until people started measuring the speed of light.
Yes. Right?
And when they measured the speed of light, they found that it was always the same speed, right?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter if you were measuring light that was crashing into the Earth head on, you know, moving opposite the direction of the Earth's movement, or light that was creeping up on the Earth from behind, right?
Mm.
Light that was moving in the same direction as the Earth.
Mm.
It was always the same speed. Well, how could that be, right?
Mm.
And so one day, this clerk in the Swiss patent office, a guy named Albert Einstein, was riding the train through Bern, Switzerland, and he was looking at the clock tower, and he said, and he started to imagine what would happen if the train that I'm on started traveling at the speed of light, right? So if you went past the clock at 11:59 and 59 seconds, and you look back at it, it would be stuck at 11:59:59, right?
Right.
Because you would be surfing on a wave of light.
Yes.
Right? And so Einstein came up with this theory of relativity, right? And I really don't understand it, but not, I don't think very many people do. But one of the things that Einstein, one of the things that is the comes out of this theory is they call it the block universe theory. And it's the idea, you know, we think of time as sort of like there's a needle on the record, right? That we're sort of, this present moment has sort of some special meaning. It's like where the present moment exists in some way that the past and future don't. But in modern physics, there's really gives no special significance to the present moment. The present moment is just happens to be where you are, right? And the present moment doesn't exist in any way that's different from other moments, other than the fact that you happen to be there.
Right. Yeah.
So what that means is that the moment you are born exists. The moment that you die exists, right?
That's really trippy.
It's just that you don't happen to be there. Right. And I wanted to read, if I can find this, when Einstein's friend Michel Besseau died. See, late in life, Einstein actually believed in a tenseless universe. And so when his friend Michel Besseau died, he wrote a letter consoling Besseau's family, and this is what he said. He said, "Now he has departed from this strange world a little ahead of me. That means nothing. People like us who believe in physics know that the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion."
That's
pretty interesting.
That's interesting and very profound at the same time. That isn't going to work if you're ever late anywhere. But
So then it all comes back to natural selection, right? So natural selection has molded our brains in ways that are very practical, right? So the idea of the past is a very practical, useful idea. The idea of the present moment is a very useful idea. The idea of the future is very useful.
Sure, yeah.
And so natural selection has given us these concepts, right?
Right.
So, it might be an illusion, but it's a very useful illusion.
It is. But also our sort of our sort of problem solving and kind of planning brains sometimes I think struggle with the kinds of just as I was trying to follow along with I can follow along how you explain the theory of relativity, but it's hard for us to wrap our brains on a day to day basis that every moment exists for instance and what all of that means, because we're sitting there planning whatever it is we're planning next day or our next vacation or whatever I find that so fascinating. I wonder how physicists keep appointments with one another sometimes.
As practical purposes go, we still live in a Newtonian universe.
Sure.
Einstein is revered as like this icon for genius.
Yeah.
But those ideas haven't really made their way.
They haven't moved on. We haven't found a way. Yeah, we haven't found a way to time travel, at least we don't think.
Yeah.
conspiracy theories aside, but time is it's really fascinating concept, and also just the way in which time seems to slow down when we're doing one thing versus something else it's just a fascinating when we're absorbed in something and an athlete thinks about time slowing down when Michael Jordan playing basketball or Lionel Messi playing soccer or football, as we call it on the continent, probably also everything's a lot slower for them. Whereas those watching people like that, they're moving at a faster pace. I don't know where that fits.
That's when you're having fun. Right?
Yeah, I don't know where that fits in the whole theory of relativity, but there's something there that time is there's a perception of time, as opposed to being an absolute thing that we've created in many ways to as a survival instinct. So that's a fascinating take on the concept. I don't know if I'd like to bring the concept of risk and uncertainty into some of this and some randomness. And I'm just wondering if throughout the as you've explored some of these concepts and some of the ways in which things have developed, if there were some decisions or some ways in which the things that we use were created based on some random decisions, because if it went one way or the other wouldn't make any difference, that have maybe profoundly now affected how we how we live and the things, the tools that we use. I don't know if there's anything like that you've come across.
Well, there are lots of designs that are suboptimal.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's the result of randomness necessarily, but it was a result of design decisions that are suboptimal. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the base 10 number system, right? People were counting on their fingers, and obviously that's the reason why we have a base 10 numbering system. But 10 is really not a very good number. I mean, it's only divisible by 2 and 5. Mm-hmm. So when I was doing a base 12 number system would have been better, because you can divide it by 3, you can divide it by 4.
Yep.
You can divide it by 2, by 3, by 4, by 6. When I was doing setting up my 401k, I had to choose my beneficiaries. And I have 3 kids, and I had to specify the percentages in whole integer.
Yep.
So when I die, 2 of my kids are going to get 33%.
Yeah.
And one of them is going to, the one that I like the most, is going to get 34%. And they're going to have to wait until I die to find out who that is. Right.
Okay.
But if we had a base 12 number system, I could easily divide.
Yeah.
Divided into thirds.
Right.
Another example of suboptimal design, I think, is left to right text direction. Because you read to the end of the line, and now you got to jump all the way across the beginning.
Yeah.
They used to write, this was back in like the 5th century BC, you can see examples of what they called ox-turning writing. You would read to the end of the line, and then you would sort of turn the way that an ox plows a field, and you would start heading back the other direction, and then you get to the beginning, and you turn, and you start, and your eye never has to leave the page. This sort of zigzag writing. So I thought that was a good idea.
Yeah, I'm wondering how that would work in practice. I suppose people get used to it, just as we've done with the left to right. I don't know if you've seen this video. There's a video about a bicycle that people that someone designed that works. So if you turn the handlebars to the right, the bicycle goes to the left.
Oh, really? Wow!
It's a fascinating. Yeah, it's very counterintuitive. But what they did in this experiment, this guy. Got on the bicycle and just and couldn't kept falling off, right? He couldn't ride it, and then after a while of practicing, it clicked, and he was able to ride the bicycle perfectly. Something happened, sort of, you know, neurons fired, or you know, something happened, and then he tried a normal bicycle, and he couldn't ride it.
Yeah, it's amazing what people can get used to.
Yeah,
I remember back in the old days when I first started at Apple. This was back when there were people who had never used a mouse before.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing a usability study of, you know, brand new users, brand new computer users. And this woman was holding the mouse, and she was sort of holding it the way you would hold a real mouse,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is sort of with the tail away from you, right?
Right.
And she was holding the mouse upside down, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And when she slid the mouse to the left, the pointer would go to the right.
Mm-hmm.
And when she slid the mouse up, the pointer would go down. And after about 10 minutes of this, she said, you know, it's easy once you get used to it.
Right.
And those are the words that I'm going to have inscribed on my tombstone.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's amazing when, you know, you describe all of these suboptimal designs, but yet somehow, you know, human beings adapt to it eventually. Like music reading, you know, I suppose if you do it, you know, at a young enough age, you can pick it up fairly quickly. But as you say, it's not optimal at all. And the same thing with, you know, the calendar. I love your post on the calendar, the optimal calendar.
So explain
that one.
Can I tell you this is the calendar that I want to have, and maybe your podcast can create sort of a groundswell of a public opinion there.
You've got a supporter in me, please explain it.
There are 12 months.
Yep.
Every month has 30 days.
Yep.
And at the end of the year, you have 5 days, or six in a leap year,
mm-hmm.
for Festivus.
Great. Yeah. I'm a big Festivus fan, by the way.
Those who do not celebrate Festivus can observe the winter holiday of their choice.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so within each 30-day month, there are 5 6-day weeks.
Mm.
So if the week were 6 days, you could have half weeks, you could have third weeks. You know, six is a much more divisible number. Well, seven's a prime number. It's a terrible number.
Yeah.
But that idea was not really my idea. Back in the after the French Revolution, the French, they wanted to get rid of everything old,
mm-hmm.
and so they invented a new calendar which was basically like that. It had 12 30-day months, but they had their weeks were 10 days long, and people didn't like that because they were used to getting off one out of every 7 days.
Yeah.
Now they only get off one out of every 10 days.
Yeah.
And so ironically, it was the workers who were the supposed beneficiaries of this new calendar who didn't like it. And they got rid of it. But then what happened was along comes Napoleon, and he comes and conquers Europe, and he introduces the metric system to Europe. At the point of a sword, mm-hmm. right? And so Europe adopted the metric system, but they didn't adopt the new calendar, mm-hmm. because, you know, they had already dropped that idea. So, anyway, I guess we're stuck with the calendar.
Yeah, that's. I mean, I like the idea of a 4-day. You know, working for 4 days, and you know, you get your 2 days off. And yeah, I think that works.
That works.
Yeah, it works for me as well. Well, yeah, maybe we can we can start a movement, but we'll see how it we'll see how it goes.
You know, you were talking about like randomness,
and
the thing that was kind of interesting to me is like how things become popular.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a study, there was a psychological study, where they let these people listen to songs, and sometimes the list of songs didn't have any numbers on them, but other times the list of songs had the number of people who had already listened to that
mm-hmm.
song.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found, and this isn't surprising, is that people tended to listen to the more popular songs.
Yeah.
Right. But what they did when they would rerun this, when they would rerun the study, start from scratch, they would find that a whole different set of songs became popular.
Right.
Every time they ran this, the study, they came up with a different set of hits. Right.
Yeah.
So it kind of makes you wonder, what if we had, what if we could rerun history? Right. Maybe there wouldn't have, maybe there wouldn't be a Beatles, right? Maybe there wouldn't be an Elvis. Maybe there wouldn't be a Bach, right? Maybe there would be a whole other set of famous musicians, right?
Yeah,
famous artists.
There probably wouldn't have been, you know, there could have been so many little things that would have made the Beatles just another band, for example, or maybe you know they didn't even get together or whatever. It's interesting. I mean, you see that phenomenon on Spotify all the time, I think, where you know you take a look at an artist and immediately, I click on if it's a new artist, I'll click on their most popular song and listen to it. And I think there's probably something in the herd instinct. I think this phenomenon happens in markets all the time. Like markets are, you know, I've got training as an economist and for my sins, right? So it's not something I bandy about on a regular basis, but you know, herd instinct is very, you know, is a big phenomenon in markets, and for no other reason than, oh, well, I think this is, you know, this is going to go up, so you know people pile into something that they know is overvalued. I mean, that's why bubbles happen in markets, for example. Right. And I think
things become popular because they're popular.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. And, you know, all these people can't be wrong. I think there's something very primal about it. And it may go back to, you know, this is where all the people are, and they're away from, you know, the lions that are going to, they're going to kill me, and I'm going to, you know, run to where all the people are. You know, I think it's very primal.
Yeah. And, they talk about that. What do they call it? The bystander syndrome.
Yes. Like yes.
Where, you know, somebody will be, people don't want to get involved. And, you know, we think of, boy, that's a very unethical way of behaving. But if you look at that from the perspective of natural selection, it's usually the smart move to do what everybody else is doing.
Mm. That's right. Yeah.
It's usually from a perspective of natural selection, it's usually a smart move to not stick your neck out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I'm not gonna, you know, it's not a very inspiring.
No, it isn't. But it is interesting. And I had Alison Taylor, who's a corruption expert, on my show a few episodes back, and we talked about whistleblowers, and you know the. Why on earth would anyone want to be a whistleblower, right? Because you could never get a job in that industry, you're ostracized, you know, and if there's any wrongdoing in an organization, what most people will do is just look for another job and leave, as opposed to call it out and fight it and, you know, all the rest. So it is interesting. Most people don't do that. There's something sort of very, as you say, very evolutionary about it. It is a bit dark, but you know, we also have the tools to spot that as well. So it's, you know, it's good to call it out.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there is a great deal of contingency to history.
Mm.
I mean, it could have gone another way, right?
Yeah.
Right. Of course, we'll never know what that other way was, but.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. And you know, sometimes like sporting events are kind of, I find in some ways, microcosms of how the world works. And if you took the same teams and you ran, you know, the same season or whatever, you know, you wouldn't necessarily get the same winner all the time. Little things can influence big outcomes. So it's interesting how that works. I'd like to talk briefly, if you've got a bit of time, about maps as well. You've got a chapter now on, or you will have a chapter on why North is up.
Yeah, so North was not always up.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at these world maps of the from medieval times, from like the 15th century, they call them T and O maps because the world is shaped like a big capital T. Mm. And then there's an O-shaped ocean around it. So, but the interesting thing about the T is that Asia is the top of the T.
Right.
And so back then you would orient a map mm-hmm. by making sure that Asia was on top. And then somebody discovered this world map of Ptolemy. Ptolemy, you know, was from the, he lived in Alexandria, and was it like a mm-hmm. 3rd century AD?
Yeah, some time ago. I don't know exactly, but yeah.
Around then.
Yeah.
And he had the most complete world map that anybody had ever put together. And we think of Ptolemy. Oh, Ptolemy was the guy who thought that the Earth was at the center of the solar system. And mm-hmm. what an idiot. Right? Well, he really wasn't an idiot. He was a very smart guy.
Yeah.
He was maybe the smartest guy around in his time. And he realized that there really was no easternmost point in the world, right?
Mm.
But there was a northernmost point in the world.
Mm.
And so it made sense to put North on top. Now, of course, if Ptolemy had been from the southern hemisphere, we would probably have South on top, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. These are all very fascinating stories, and very very useful that you've done this work and kind of pull it all together. When does the book come out? When are you?
It is soon to be a major bestseller. I just haven't found a publisher yet.
Okay.
So, but I actually haven't finished the manuscript either. So,
okay.
I'm very active in social media,
mm-hmm.
Very active on Twitter. So, if anybody wants to check out Making of Sense on Twitter, I'm posting stuff there all the time.
Great.
I hope to be. We're also working on podcasts, producing podcasts.
Sure.
So, yeah. We're going to get into the podcast biz like you are.
I'll look forward to it, and feel free to. Hit me up for any suggestions or mistakes. I make mistakes along the way, which is great, but you don't have to repeat them.
Yeah, but it's fun. I mean, I really like thinking about this stuff and reading about this stuff, and I'm finding that there are a lot of people who are into this stuff.
Definitely,
and it's a book for nerds, right? and I mean that in the most complimentary and endearing sense of the word. Right?
Yeah. No. I was just gonna say. I mean that nerds are very popular. I should say geek. I think nerd is a little more pejorative.
I think
geek is a much more positive positive word, but that means roughly the same thing.
I hope everybody will embrace their inner geek.
Yeah.
And check out my Twitter feed.
I'll put it all in the show notes, Kevin, and we'll make sure that people know where to find you. I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to discuss along this theme. I did like the post that you did on music as well, the sort of why do we have music and whether or not it's
the interesting thing about that is if you look at that from the perspective of natural selection,
yeah,
like why are people musical? I mean, it doesn't seem to have any practical advantage, mm. right? It doesn't help you find food. It doesn't help you win battles. If anything, it makes you counterproductive. It's like mm. the the Bob Marley song, you know, I don't want to work, I just want to bang on the drum all day, right? And so that is a question that it's sort of a perplexing question for evolutionary theorists. Mm. And so there are different theories. One is that this idea of what they call musa language, right? So language evolved, and there are definitely practical advantages to having language. And music evolved as sort of along with language. And there is kind of a sing-songiness to language, right? You can say, okay, or you can say, okay. Or you can say, okay, you know. Mm-hmm. There is a tonality to language, right? So music and language kind of go together in that way. Another theory is what they call the motherese theory, mm-hmm. which is that, you know, because humans have these big brains and big skulls, it became necessary for women to give birth to babies before they really weren't ready for the world, right? And so human mothers had to nurture these babies, and so the first songs were lullabies, right? And so music was one of the ways that mothers and babies formed these strong emotional bonds that they have, right? Mm. And then the other theory, and this is the one that Darwin believed in, was that music is the product of sexual selection. Mm-hmm. And sexual selection is when you look at some preposterous thing, like the tail of a peacock. Like, why does a peacock have a tail? Well, there's no practical reason for a male peacock to have a tail like that. Mm. But the reason he has it is because female peacocks like it, right? If you have a nice looking tail, you're going to be more likely to breed with another peacock, right? and your offspring will inherit that tendency to like big fancy tails, right? And so the idea is that music is the result of sexual selection. And you don't have to look very far in the culture to see a connection between music and sex, right? Mm-hmm. Musicians are sexy, right? Mm-hmm. And a guy like, you know, Mick Jagger or Jimi Hendrix or whoever, they do pretty well with the women.
Right.
So yeah. The idea is that music evolved for brains that were, you know, attracted to the things that we're attracted to. And then last but not least, there is another theory, which is sort of none of the above, right? That music is just the byproduct of other things. Like, you know, it's Steven Pinker, who I'm a big Steven Pinker. Mm. He said that music is auditory cheesecake, right? Okay. So why do people like cheesecake? People didn't evolve to like cheesecake. Right, mm-hmm. People did evolve to like fat and cool water and sugar, right? Mm-hmm. And a cheesecake is like a pleasure technology that pushes all those buttons,
right?
And music is similarly a pleasure technology that pushes all these buttons in our brains, but those buttons are there for other reasons,
right? I think that hits on something, but. And I think we could talk about the same sort of thing with regard to art. You know, why are we attracted to certain forms of art and pictures and things like that? And that's where I think there's a really interesting, you know, music allows us to maybe explore, you know, parts of ourselves that we don't, you know, that we don't really know, or, you know, there's some maybe inner workings in our subconscious mind that allows us to make certain connections that we wouldn't in our kind of, you know, our sort of problem solving brains. But I'm not sure that we've fully uncovered, what all those things are.
Yeah, there was a zoologist back in the 50s, Nico Tinbergen. Mm-hmm. That name ring a bell?
Not really. Not. I haven't heard of him, but
He did a study of baby seagulls,
uh-huh.
And so baby seagulls peck at their mother's beaks, mm. you know, to beg for food, and so he did a study where he had these fake beaks made out of cardboard, mm-hmm. right? And what he found was that with some of the fake beaks, the seagulls were more attracted to the fake beaks than they are to a real beak, right? So what they found was that the thinner the beak and the more pronounced the dot on the beak, the more these baby seagulls wanted to peck it. So he came up with the idea of what he called supernormal stimuli. And a lot of art, I think, is supernormal stimuli.
Interesting.
Right? You go to the movies and it's like, whoa, everything's bigger than life, right? I mean, pornography is supernormal stimuli. So we love supernormal stimuli.
Right, yeah.
And we pay a lot of money to go to these movies and see these big, magnificent, spectacular things that are more interesting than real life.
Yeah, that is an interesting interesting theory around it. I think it's one of life's mysteries. But you've done a wonderful job of trying to of pull all of these things together. I really looking forward to reading your book when it comes out.
Good.
this is all fascinating stuff. I think there are a lot of people that would be very interested in it, and I've enjoyed reading your blog, and it's themakingofsense.com, right?
Right.
And that's where people can find you. I think we've covered a lot of ground, Kevin. So I don't want to keep you any longer.
Okay.
But thank you so much for coming on. And let's definitely stay in touch. Looking forward to the book coming out. And all the best with it.
Okay. Thanks. This was fun.
Thanks, Kevin.
Well, as I mentioned, I thought that was a very fun conversation. Check out Kevin's site, be on the lookout for his book. And I thought that one of the takeaways of the discussion was that, as Kevin says, we do stand on the shoulders of giants. Many of the things that we take for granted haven't necessarily been designed with a sort of the best user experience in mind. And I just find that a very strangely empowering concept. As I said in the intro, I think for a couple of reasons. One is because it implies that things don't always have to be, the way that they are. And secondly, it implies that things that we may think of as, I guess, constraints, because maybe they've been well thought out or whatever, they may similarly not be constraints in practice, and they may be far more random than we actually think. Both of those implications, I think, give us a sense of empowerment, really. Well, I think we're going to have to wrap it up this time around. If you did like this episode, and if you do like the show, again, please share it. Please provide a review or rating on iTunes. That helps us out a lot. Follow us on Twitter at RiskThings is the handle. Email me with any feedback that you have, allthingsrisk@gmail.com, and check out my website, allthingsrisk.com. We've got loads more in store for you. Stay tuned. In the interim, don't forget, risk is life.